Okay, folks, we'll get underway. Many thanks for coming along tonight to hear Minister Chris Bowen speak. I'll introduce him very briefly in a minute. Just remember to any comments you make to keep them brief and to the point. And thanks to King & Wood Mellison for providing this very fine venue for us this evening. So Chris Bowen is a good friend of the Sydney Institute. He's spoken here on a number of occasions, a member for the House of Representatives since 2004, initially at Prospect after redistribution McMahon. He's held, as you know, senior positions in opposition and in government, and including as Treasurer briefly, and now, of course, as Minister for Climate Change and Energy. And the Minister's going to speak for the Sydney Institute tonight on the topic of ambitious but achievable energy security, affordability and emissions reduction. Mr. Bowen, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared and Anne, for the invitation to be here this evening. And of course, a short sprint away from here is 121 Macquarie Street, the Chief Secretary's building. A typically beautiful and impressive building. The Sydney Sandstone is obviously well known to all of us, and it's rightly on the state's heritage register. But it was also the home of the Aborigines Welfare Board until the board's abolition in 1969. The board could and did control where Aboriginal people lived, worked, and was authorised to remove Aboriginal people from their families. It housed some of the cogs of the machinery of the stolen generation. So with that reminder about how close to home our history is, as I acknowledge the elders of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respects to them, I also acknowledge that the work of repair and reconciliation in our country is far from complete. But we can take a huge step forward later this year in recognition and reconciliation. The Australian people will vote for what is a simple proposition: that our First Peoples be recognised in our nation's governing document and that they be consulted on matters affecting them. It'll be an important inflection point for our country. It's a conversation and change that I think our nation is ready for, and I'm confident we will answer the Uluru Statement from the heart with the same positive spirit in which Indigenous leaders made it nearly 6 years ago. Well, I thought the most productive thing I could do this evening is share some thoughts about our approach to climate change and energy policy 10 months into government, as we approach the first anniversary in approximately 10 weeks' time of our election, to share some thoughts on what we've managed to achieve so far and what we need to achieve over the coming decade. And I'll start perhaps with a brief personal reflection. People often ask me if I'm enjoying this job. Jacqueline asked me a few moments ago. And my answer is, how could I not be? I've held a lot of portfolios over the years. Jared mentioned a couple of them. But this, in my view, is by far the most important portfolio I've ever held. And it's one that I relish every day. The stakes are high. Climate change is an existential threat to our health, to our environment, to our economy, to our national security. There are a myriad of examples I could use to underline this point. But I'll leave you with just one, which I find particularly compelling. Our country, as we all know, was ravaged by bushfire in 2019 and 2020. The toll was physically, environmentally, emotionally enormous for our country. If climate change continues unabated, the conditions that led to those firestorms will be the average conditions by the 2040s. And by the 2060s, the conditions of that 2019-2020 summer will be regarded as a good year. We can't let that happen to our country. Conversely, action on climate change is arguably the biggest economic opportunity for our country in the next two decades. For 235 years, we've been in search of comparative advantage. And renewable energy is probably, and I believe is, the biggest chance for comparative advantage we have ever been presented with. It's unthinkable to me that we would miss that opportunity. The task is massive. The world's transition to renewable energy is the biggest economic change since the Industrial Revolution, and the time frame is tight. The key to holding the world as close as possible to 1.5 degrees of warming is the reduction of cumulative emissions between now and 2030. 2030 is 82 months away. That's a comparative blink of the eye. And of course, the size and importance of this task is magnified even further when you factor in the complexity of undertaking this task against a backdrop of the dramatic dislocation in world energy markets. The responsibility of putting downward pressure on energy prices for household budgets and the viability of Australian businesses, particularly energy-hungry manufacturing, within this complex environment is not one I take lightly. This task is encapsulated by the concept of the energy trilemma, the imperative of affordability, security, and emissions reduction. The good news is that the answer to each of these questions, these challenges, is the same: the transition to the cheapest form of energy available, renewable energy, and to do so in a way which is much faster and much more orderly than has been the case over the last decade. As I said, tonight I thought I'd share with you some of the thinking that underpins our approach to climate and energy policy, but first I want to spend a few moments on the more urgent of the challenges that we've faced over the last 10 months, dealing with skyrocketing energy prices around the world. We recently, of course, marked the first anniversary of the immoral and illegal invasion of Ukraine by Russia, a tragic, brutal and unnecessary anniversary, and one, even more sadly, where we note that it's unclear how or when it will end. One of the most significant global repercussions, of course, has been the impact on the world energy markets. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has had devastating impacts on energy security, with much of Europe held captive over the supply of oil and gas from Russia. It's also had severe impacts on energy affordability right around the world. The World Economic Forum found that the conflict has nearly doubled household energy costs worldwide. And despite our distance from the conflict, Australia has not been, of course, immune. These pressures transformed into the greatest global energy crisis since at least the 1970s. We saw the price of gas and coal jump across the globe, including in Australia, and these price hikes had a devastating impact on domestic energy markets. We saw the price, the domestic average price of gas, jump from $10 a gigajoule at the time of Russia's invasion of Ukraine to $32 a gigajoule by the time of the election. Along with similar price hikes for coal, the impacts on prices were severe. Average household electricity prices jumped from $85 a megawatt hour at the start of the Russian invasion to $286 a megawatt hour at the time of the election. This hike in energy prices was seen, of course, right across the world. And the IEA reported 90% of these price hikes were due to the impacts of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Now, we've been frank about what this means for energy costs. Treasury forecasts a 20% rise in electricity costs in 2022-23 and a 36% rise in electricity costs in 2023-24. For gas prices, it was a 20% increase in both years. Of course, this is what led to our decision to introduce coal and gas price caps in December. We couldn't sit on the sidelines and watch this impact on Australian households and businesses. It was a big decision, not one we took lightly. Our caps were set to account for a reasonable profit margin, not an unjustified one. And encouragingly, we're starting to see some of the signs that that action is having in dampening price rises. Far from the peak seen in the middle of the year, the average wholesale electricity prices in February this year, 1 year after Russia launched its invasion, were down to $83 a megawatt hour. At the time the interventions were announced, Treasury estimated that electricity prices nationally would be 13 percentage points less in 2023-24 than if we hadn't taken action. And futures markets have responded accordingly. A recent comparison of the 2023 wholesale electricity prices in November with the prices in February shows that forecast wholesale prices for 2023 have dropped by up to 48%. And yet there are some who still criticise this intervention. This week, the Australian Energy Regulator will release the draft default market offer, the reference price for residential and small business prices in New South Wales, South Australia and South East Queensland. And I'm not going to preempt the AER's determination, of course, but I do want to give some insight into exactly why the government had to act in December. In November, the AER, the Australian Energy Regulator, advised us that without action, the residential DMO would increase by between 35 and 44% in New South Wales, by 51% in South Australia, and by 41% in South East Queensland. Based on these numbers, the government estimated for small business customers that the increases were 37% in New South Wales, 53% in South Australia and 50% in South East Queensland. We simply had to act. We couldn't allow that situation to unfold. I expect the draft DMO released this week to be significantly lower than the AER's predictions pre-intervention. Now, I know that'll be cold comfort for those who'll still be hit with resulting energy bill increases. That's why our energy relief plan also included consumer and small business rebates, additional targeted assistance to those who need it most. Now, of course, the public debate around energy prices is highly politically contested, just as the broader climate change debate is. Climate politics in Australia has been tribal for many years. There remain climate deniers and delays in the federal parliament, and frankly, the opposition remains stuck in the same gear as they were for the last decade, decrying action on climate change as being dangerous to the economy and remaining silent on the risks of inaction, rather than seeing it as the massive investment and job creation opportunity that it actually is. Likewise, others are quick to label any action as not good enough, rapid to call for more while ignoring the complexities and imperatives of managing this complex transition to ensure that our lights stay on and our industrial base is nurtured and expanded during this vital transformation. What each of these approaches lack is melding together of ambition and a focus on being achievable. Those who opposed our Climate Act in Parliament with its target of 43% reduction by 2030 as being too ambitious, that's to say the federal opposition, are simply ignoring the imperative of acting. They also voted against our electric vehicle tax cut, our energy bill relief package, and are currently opposing reforms to the safeguard mechanism. That's choosing to make yourself irrelevant in the most important economic and policy challenge facing our country. Similarly, slogans and calls for faster action often ignore the realities and complexities of the task we're undertaking. Our approach is centrist, but it's far from timid. We receive criticism from the left and the right, but we continue with alacrity because this middle way is the right way, and it's our great responsibility to make a policy, not make a point. Because to achieve 43% economy-wide emissions reduction by 2030 from a standing start, we're going to need a massive whole-of-society effort which embraces every sector of our economy. Now, tonight I'll just talk about two of those sectors, electricity and, topically, industry. When we came to office, 32% of our electricity came from renewable energy. Our commitment is to lift this to 82% in 82 months. This is going to be no small task. We'll do it in a number of ways. The passage of our Climate Act through Parliament was vital in sending the message to renewable energy investors that Australia has an ambitious but stable policy environment to foster investment, and investors around the world have told me that the passage of the Act is vital for encouraging more renewable energy investment. Large-scale wind and solar farm investment commitments grew by nearly 50% in 2022, with 4.3 gigawatts of large-scale energy capacity achieving final investment decision, most of it after the election. To put this in perspective, 4.3 gigawatts is enough to power more than 3 million homes. The second half of last year also saw a step up in rooftop solar investment by households and businesses, with over 300,000 small-scale rooftop solar systems installed in 2022, contributing an additional 2.8 gigawatts of renewable energy capacity. But there's much more to do. We'll achieve our 82% target through various policy levers. Our Rewiring the Nation policy is absolutely vital to upgrading the grid to cater for much greater renewable penetration, because there's no transition without transmission. I'm pleased that in our first 10 months, we've inked comprehensive deals under Rewiring the Nation with New South Wales, Victoria and Tasmania, and negotiations with the remaining jurisdictions are advancing well. And we'll keep the much-needed focus on reliability through our capacity investment scheme. After 4 gigawatts of dispatchable power came out of the grid over the last decade and only 1 gigawatt replaced it, states and territories unanimously agreed with us in December on a model to further enhance stability and certainty for investors and unleash at least $10 billion and at least 6 gigawatts of investment in dispatchable renewable energy through the capacity investment scheme. And we'll do other things as well. We'll work with communities around Australia to develop Australia's offshore wind industry. It strikes me as many different levels of crazy that Australia, that the world's largest island, Australia, has no offshore wind industry as we speak. I'll give you an idea of the scale of that we're talking about. One proposed wind farm in the offshore wind zone that I've already officially declared off the Gippsland coast, one of the proposed farms, will generate 20% of Victoria's current energy needs. That's just one wind farm. We're currently consulting on the appropriate borders for the Hunter offshore wind zone, the second one. But the 5,000 square kilometres in the draft zone would be enough for 8 gigawatts of power, or enough to power 6 million homes. We'll also do it through building storage for our renewable industry, 400 community batteries and the large-scale grid-scale batteries, large-size grid-scale batteries that I announced funding for last year, and much more as well. This is the sort of effort we're going to need to achieve these important targets. Now, as important as the electricity sector is, converting our electricity grid to 82% renewables won't be enough to see our emissions come down by 43%. The reforms to the safeguard mechanism that we're currently steering through the Parliament cover 28% of our emissions and are also absolutely vital for our efforts. Safeguard reforms are complex in their nature, but they're simple in their intent: to ensure our biggest emitters contribute their fair share of emissions reductions. That's 205 million tonnes of abatement. That's equivalent to around a third of our emissions reduction task, or taking two-thirds of our cars off the roads. It's an ambitious reform, but a sensible one. Ensuring industry takes a fair share of responsibility for emissions reduction while including variables to account for increased productivity and growth, as our design does. And critically, it incentivises on-site emissions reduction through the creation of safeguard mechanism credits. What this means in practice is that a facility is close to its baseline or its emissions ceiling, and that baseline declines by a small percentage a year, the facility has the choice of buying offsets or making big capital investments in technology that could halve their emissions, for example. Without crediting, these capital investments are not rewarded and inevitably would be put off. Again, our approach is to be ambitious but to focus on the achievable. Providing a framework for 4.9% emissions reduction each and every year from safeguards facilities is ambitious, 4.9% each and every year. But because of that level of ambition and the breadth and variety of the sectors covered, it is necessary to provide flexibility to industries to ensure that ambition is achievable. I understand the emphasis on possible new facilities in the debate, but this reform is about reducing emissions from all facilities, old and new, industrial and resources. The fact is, if our reforms are passed, there'll be a scheme to ensure emissions come down from big emitters, whether they be old or new. If they don't pass, there'll be no such scheme. It'll be business as usual. Emissions from covered facilities have gone up 4% since the scheme came in 2016. No reform means no change. It means emissions continuing to rise. One of the issues that's been raised is in relation to our reforms is the future of gas, and I want to spend a moment or two on that. There are ideological positions on both sides. Our position is grounded in the practicalities. The previous government promoted a gas-led recovery. It was and remains, in my view, a fraudulent concept. Between 2014 and 2021, East Coast gas production increased 300%. Yet despite supply going up significantly, the prices paid by Australian households and Australian industry also went up by 420% in real terms over that same period of time. Former government was warned on at least a dozen occasions that because of their inaction, we were hurtling towards a supply problem in the domestic market. In 2017, the Australian Energy Market Commission warned, and I quote, "Reforms need now so consumers don't pay more than necessary for their gas." But nothing happened. On the other side of the debate, some call for an immediate ban on future gas or the cancelling of long-term contracts with key trading partners. Both of these options would be irresponsible and not countenanced by the government. These are the same trading partners we'll need to help us drive the energy transformation, and sovereign risk created would be simply untenable. I've mentioned our plan to lift the energy mix to 82% renewable by 2030. As big as and ambitious as this lift is, it would still leave 18% of our electricity mix as non-renewable. And as ageing coal-fired power stations leave the grid, that 18% will increasingly be focused on gas. Gas is a flexible fuel necessary for peaking and firming as we undertake this transformation. And what I've mentioned just relates to electricity. That's before we get to the need of industrial manufacturers for gas as feedstock or direct energy. I'm an optimist about the future role of biofuels and green hydrogen, but they're some way off yet. The ACCC January Gas Inquiry report forecast a 30 petajoule shortfall for 2023 in Australia's East Coast gas market if LNG producers export all of their uncontracted gas. But the ACCC notes that there is 58 petajoules of uncontracted gas available in the domestic market. What this means is that in 2023, East Coast LNG producers have sufficient uncontracted gas available to them to address the forecast shortfall. We want to see that uncontracted gas flow to Australian households and businesses at a reasonable price. But in future years, the ACCC notes that the situation is not as secure. Specifically, in the East Coast from 2027, the ACCC notes that there are likely to be shortfalls across the East Coast gas market arising from domestic and export demand without steps being taken. So this isn't ideological. It's simply practical. Electrification will ramp up, renewable adoption will grow, but there still will need to be gas in the system, especially for industrial and commercial users. Hence, Minister Madeleine King's progressing consideration of reforms, the Australian Domestic Gas Supply Mechanism, known affectionately to some and less affectionately to others as the gas trigger, and I, together with the Treasurer, am progressing a mandatory code of conduct. These are all important. But we'll also continue to take a practical and evidence-based approach to policy questions around gas. Practical and evidence-based policy is good policy, but being practical and evidence-based should not be portrayed or mistaken as lacking passion. I mentioned earlier how much I relish this job. Getting this transition right is the main game in determining the prosperity of our nation in coming decades. There is no imperative greater for governments in this age than playing our role collectively in holding the world as close as possible to 1.5 degrees of warming. None. There's no greater economic opportunity for our country than developing our potential as a renewable energy powerhouse to provide our own energy needs and increasingly be a supplier of cheap and renewable energy to the world. Too much time has been wasted in this country on climate-related identity politics and tribal games. We now have not a second to waste. I'm pleased with the progress we've made in our first 10 months. Pleased, but far from satisfied, because there's so much more to do on this, the most important task before us. And getting on with our job is exactly what we intend to do from now and into the future. Thank you for your time.
So many thanks to the Minister for an important address. And so we go to questions and discussion. As I said earlier, please keep your comments or your questions brief. Can I just start off, I think it was a speech you gave recently or a report of a comment you made recently about renewables and in regard to national security, as you mentioned earlier. I think the figure is something like Australia's importing something like 90% of what we're using for renewables, which would make our nation quite dependent on those nations who are producing renewables. What's the government's position on that?
So it's a big issue, Jared. It's a big issue not just for us. It's a big issue for every country undertaking this massive transition. The figures I think you're referring to in a speech I made in Washington, which noted that at the moment, 85% of the world's solar panels come from China. In the next 3 years, that will rise to more than 97% as China just ramps up production. And similar figures could be deployed for batteries, inverters, transformers, the whole lot. There's an urgent need to diversify and strengthen supply chains, because regardless of which country it is, relying on one country for 97% is a highly risky proposition. When I think about the things which could slow or stop our transition, there's a few things that could slow us, but really only a disruption to our supply chain could really seriously threaten to stop us. So it's in our interest to increase domestic sovereignty in production. We put 60 million solar panels in our roofs in the last decade, and 1% of them were made in Australia. And the modern solar panels, an Australian invention, was invented in Randwick, the modern solar panel at the University of New South Wales. And yet we made 1% of our own solar panels over the last decade. It is inconceivable to me that we would do that over the next decade. We need to put, to reach our targets, we need to put another 60 million solar panels on roofs in the next 7 years. It's inconceivable to me that we would carry on making 1% of them in Australia. So that's why our National Reconstruction Funds, for example, is important, for example, for important co-investments. That's why our National Battery Precinct policy in Gladstone and Queensland is important. That's why I chair the Quad Energy Ministers. We focus entirely on supply chain in the Quad and what we can do together. We want the United States making more things. We want all like-mindeds making more things. We want India making more things, as the Prime Minister said. And it's in their interest for us to make more things to diversify these supply chains on renewable energy, because an over-reliance on a supply chain which might be impacted by any number of geopolitical events is, I think, deeply problematic for this massive transformation.
Okay, so there's a question. There's one over there. Okay, we've got plenty of time, okay? And then one here.
Oh, thank you. My name's Nick Berry. If nuclear energy is so expensive, why would it be that they're paying 6.2 cents per kilowatt hour for energy in Ontario, Canada, whereas in New South Wales, ACT and Victoria, they're paying between 21 and 27 cents per kilowatt hour?
Well, nuclear energy is expensive, and that's the reason I oppose it. And it's not just me who thinks it. If you look at the Gen Cost report by CSIRO, AEMO, you know, experts in their field, they find that the cheapest form of energy is renewable, followed by gas, followed by coal, followed by nuclear. And if you look at the nuclear expansions or constructions underway in the world at the moment, they are all over cost, dramatically. And most of them are behind time, quite substantially. And that's in countries with a nuclear industry. If you're starting in Australia from scratch with only one small medical-related nuclear reactor, no nuclear industry to speak of, our cost of developing would be substantially higher, 10 to 15% higher, most economists would agree. So my objection to nuclear energy is entirely economic. It doesn't stack up, certainly not for Australia. And when you consider our comparative advantage of renewable energy, more sunlight hits our landmass than any other nation in the world, above average wind, why we would seek to start an industry which we don't have, which is the most expensive, is beyond me. It's just beyond me. Plus the delay, the run-up time. You know, even advocates of small modular reactors recognise, sensible ones recognise, they're many, many years away. They're not viable to achieve our 2030 targets. And nor is nuclear necessarily, you know, entirely reliable. France gets quoted a lot. A lot of France's nuclear reactors have been out of action over the last 12 months, and it's been part of their problem. So I don't support nuclear power for Australia. It's entirely uneconomic. If other countries with a developed nuclear industry choose to expand it, obviously entirely matter for them. But it won't be happening here, not while we're in office.
Michael DePercy, University of Canberra. Minister, you've said that nuclear is not an option. So if the push to renewables is not achievable in time and the lights go out, what's your plan B?
Well, my plan B is not to happen. My plan is to ensure this transition is more orderly, as I said. So the problem for the last decade has been coal-fired power stations have left the grid, almost inevitably, but not enough new power has come on to replace it, not enough storage, and not enough transmission. I talked a little bit about the importance of transmission. The $20 billion we're expending on transmission through rewiring the nation. That's important for a number of reasons, because a renewable energy grid is very different. Coal and gas tends to be geographically concentrated in particular areas, whereas renewables can be spread much more across the country. Also, increasingly, we're a two-way grid. At the moment, the grid's a one-way street. Increasingly, with distributed energy, it'll be a two-way system. And also, you know, people say the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. Well, that's true. It's normally blowing or shining somewhere on the national energy grid. So improving transmission to move the energy around is part of a very important part of the mix, as is increasing storage. We're going to need more batteries, but batteries will only get us through a short period of time, an evening or two. As important as they are, we're going to need grid-scale household and community, but we're going to need pumped hydro and we're going to need green hydrogen as well. So I don't accept with respect the premise that, you know, the transition automatically leads to those sorts of outcomes. It does if we don't get it right. It does if we continue to see 4 gigawatts come off and only 1 gigawatt come on. We need to see a lot more gigawatts come on. And that underpins everything we're doing.
Thank you. Thank you, Minister. Dennis Bluth, Hunter Lakes. Can I take you back to your preliminary remarks regarding the existential threat based on climate change, particularly the existential threat that you mentioned in relation to the severe bushfires and the severe droughts that we have had and that we will continue to experience. And this existential threat underpins the Hunter Lake scheme, to which you may be familiar with, which is to repurpose the mining voids in the Hunter Valley into lakes to capture excess water to the extent of multiple Sydney harbours. And also, it lends itself to pumped hydro and floating solar with, as you would appreciate, immediate access to the grid, unlike a number of existing solar and wind farms, and dare I mention, unlike Snowy 2, which we won't mention. Anyway, the question is just whether the funding that you have referred to, particularly the capacity investment scheme, would be available for the Hunter Lakes project, as I've discussed.
I'm aware of the project, and you know, in principle, it's a fine one, subject to all the necessary processes you'd need to go through. You will need to go through. Yes, the capacity investment mechanism is available for dispatchable renewable energy. If it's renewable and dispatchable, it qualifies. Then you've got to make a solid bid under the capacity investment auctions, and your bid has to stack up. But yes, it would qualify.
Minister Tim Reid from the Business Council. Firstly, thank you for your address tonight, and more importantly, thank you for your leadership on these critical issues. I'm interested in asking a couple of questions about the safeguard mechanism. It would appear as though it's facing some challenges in the Senate, so anything you can elaborate on there would be helpful. But perhaps more specifically, when I was in front of the Senate committee hearing a couple of weeks ago, it seemed to me that there was a conflation of issues between the safeguard mechanism and having confidence in the credit in the effectiveness of ACCUs. And in your mind, did Professor Chubb's report do what you wanted it to do? And do you feel like that has put the credibility of ACCUs to the side, or do you think there's more that still needs to be done on that matter?
Before you do that, just tell us ACCUs.
Sure. I'll provide a bit of context. Thank you, Tim, and thank you for your leadership of the business community and the way the Business Council has engaged in recent years. Since you took over, it's been very productive and constructive, and I thank you and the BCA for that. Firstly, in relation to the safeguard mechanism, its passage for Parliament. Negotiations are ongoing. They're in good faith. They're productive and constructive, but they're ongoing. I would be happy to negotiate with anybody of good faith across the Parliament, but the opposition has said before they even seen the legislation, they're against it. So there's no point negotiating with somebody who's against it. So I'll negotiate with the crossbench. I simply would point out, while the negotiations are ongoing, this is not unusual. Since we won the election, you know, we passed the Climate Act when we started, we did not have the numbers in the Senate. We did not have the numbers for the energy relief package. We did not have the numbers for the electricity, electric vehicle tax cut, all of which in my portfolio, all of which were passed. You sit down and you work issues through. That's what a sensible government of grown-ups does. Negotiates with people of good faith on areas of commonality. There are areas where clearly we have a very different view of the Greens, and I made it clear to Mr. Baird. No point talking about that because that crosses our red line, and he's got similar issues, quite rightly, quite similar red lines, quite fair enough. So those negotiations are ongoing, and I'll continue to negotiate in good faith because this is important, because, as I said, if it doesn't pass, it's business as usual, and we can't afford business as usual as a nation. In relation to ACCUs, Australian Carbon Credit Units, so this is, we probably have the most mature carbon credit system in the world, where people get to generate a product which reduces emissions. It's very highly regulated, and they can then trade those credits. And what we're doing as part of the safeguard mechanism, because we're requiring 4.9% emissions reduction each and every year, we're allowing people to use ACCUs to achieve some of that. Now, you pointed to the Chubb review, which I commissioned soon after the election, because we did have concerns about the veracity of the system and it's whether it's fit for purpose. It's been around for a long time. You asked whether it achieved what I wanted it to do. It was entirely and appropriately arm's length and independent process. So they had no writing instructions for me other than do a very thorough job. My job was to pick the right people. So I asked Professor Ian Chubb, a former chief scientist, the Honourable Dr. Annabel Bennett, ACKC, Dr. Stephen Hatfield-Dodds, and Ariadne Goring. They're the panel. I could not have found four more credentialed, experienced, respected people. And they did a very thorough job. Now, what they've done is examine the ACCU system and found it's fundamentally fit for purpose, but they've recommended reforms. And even the critics of the ACCU system who say Professor Chubb and his panel didn't go far enough, even the critics have acknowledged that the governance changes that they've recommended and I have accepted in total world's best practice governance changes. Removes me from the system, removes the minister of the day from the system of establishing ACCU methods, creates an independent committee with a full-time chair, thoroughly resourced and independent, and regulation and accreditation of carbon credit market providers. World's best practice, we already have the most regulated and thorough system in the world, and now we have an even better system. Now, some of the argument goes to whether the very concept of offsets should be accepted. You know, people say you can't offset your way to 1.5 degrees, that emissions reduction on site is better than offsetting. I actually do agree with that. Of course, emissions reduction on site is better. That's why we're also creating the safeguard credits to encourage on-site abatement. But while I accept you can't do it alone with credits, you can't do it without credits. You can't. They're the net in the net zero. People say net zero like it's a slogan. Actually, the net comes from carbon credits. Otherwise, you're talking about absolute zero, which is a whole different kettle of fish. So you've got to have it as part of the system. And as I said, because we're actually embarking on ambitious emissions reduction, 4.9% a year, each and every year, that's ambitious. You do have to allow that flexibility to say you can do that through credits. But of course, the credits cost money. And that then provides a framework and an incentive for businesses to consider investments in on-site abatement, particularly as it becomes available. At the moment, for some, it's not very available. Cement, the technology, is not well advanced. Hopefully by 2030, and there's been reports showing by 2030 but long, it will. And you know, green steel will develop and it'll be easier for aluminium. But as we stand in 2023, some of that technology is still emerging. So either you say, well, don't worry about it, you're fine, we'll get to you later. Post 2030, we might start to think about emissions reduction. Or you provide the framework now and you allow access to credits. That's what we've chosen to do.
Question over here.
Yes. Japan is building HELE coal-fired power stations that have 49.1% thermal efficiency, which is double our coal-fired power stations. But we can't have them here because of the renewable energy target, with its subsidies of $7 billion a year before rolling out transmission lines. And that's supposed to come off in 2030. But I think do you agree that the overseas investors will try to persuade you to keep it there? I mean, Australia, you're known as the treasurer of Treasure Island. This is a country with lots of, you know, so will you... Do you intend to really, if you take that off, what will happen?
Oh, well, that does run out in 2030, and we have no intention of continuing it because we don't need to, because renewable energy is now so cheap. That was necessary when renewable energy wasn't the cheapest form of energy. It now is. And we have a whole bunch of other plans, some of which I referred to. I must say I don't agree. A HELE coal plant is still very high emissions compared to the alternative of renewable energy. Very high emissions.
I've just got a question from one of our Zoom listeners, and very brief question. Will we be getting yearly updates on the progress of Australia's transition to renewable energy?
Absolutely, and we legislated that, so that's in our Climate Act. Good question. One of the elements of our Climate Act was not just the targets. It was that me, or the Minister of the day, is required under law to give an annual statement to Parliament on how we're going. There's climate change authority advice, which I must release under law as to how we're going. I did that because I believe in transparency and I believe in accountability. And if we are falling short in any area, as uncomfortable as that might be on any particular day, it's very important that we say so and talk about what we're doing to turn that around. And indeed, if we're doing better in some areas, that's something to celebrate as well.
Question here.
As a young person, firstly, thank you so much for just having such a very wide-ranging transition plan just to, you know, help my generation have a sustainable future going forward. But my question is regarding Albo's recent visit to India. From what I've heard, India has a quite strongly developing solar industry. And obviously, from what I believe, India is moving towards a net zero target towards 2070 for their circumstances, quite impressive. So considering all that, I'm just curious to hear if you and your Indian counterpart, or just our two countries, have plans to cooperate with or trade with renewable energy.
Yeah, great question. And the answer is yes. India is a very important partner in the Quad and chair of the G20 this year. They are a key partner in renewable energy. The Prime Ministers, announced a solar alliance in recent days, which is about collaboration on research and development. The Indian Energy Minister was one of my first visitors after the election, R.K. Singh, and I took him to the photovoltaic research centre at the University of New South Wales, where they invented PERC, the modern solar panel, and he was very impressed. He's an engineer by background, so he's very focused on efficiency, and is very impressed with the work that we're doing in Australia to increase solar efficiency. And they're key partners in the G20, of course, and we will do anything we can to support a very successful G20 chairmanship by them this year. So, yes, there's much to do with India.
Yes, question here, and then... Philip Wood, Minister, you say that you champion a data-based policy. In my hands, I have a chart which plots the cost of household electricity in about 100 countries relative to the level of solar and wind installation. And there is a pretty strong linear correlation between the level of installation of solar and wind and the household price of electricity being higher. Can you name for us some countries around the world with high levels of solar and wind that don't have commensurately high electricity prices?
Well, I fundamentally reject the underlying precept that you're putting forward, that solar is expensive. It isn't. It isn't. I mean, and any cost of solar comes from capital. There's no cost of ongoing, in effect, ongoing running of a solar energy system. So I don't accept the premise of that question, and indeed, I just refer you back to the CSIRO Australian Energy Market Operator Report, GenCost. I highly recommend the report to you, which is very thorough in its analysis. It finds renewable energy is the cheapest form of energy, and that is just an uncontrovertible fact, in my view. Yes, the transition is important. There's a whole bunch of factors which lead to energy prices. Solar energy did not cause the invasion of Ukraine. Vladimir Putin did. Vladimir Putin weaponized energy by cutting off energy supplies to Europe. And I will not have renewable energy blamed for energy price rises here or anywhere else.
What is your philosophy on addressing social cost of renewable transition that is moving workers to other industries?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a real issue. But it's also an opportunity. I mean, there's a lot of jobs to be created in this transformation, whether it is transmission, storage, energy efficiency is highly labour intensive. In fact, one of the challenges will be getting enough workers to do it. That'll be a challenge around the world. And we talked about supply chain, but in equally countries will be competing for skilled labour in energy. But this is important. There's very good work being done by non-government organisations like the Hunter Jobs Alliance, which is doing a lot of work on this. And I find that I spend a lot of time in the regions, as I should, in the energy producing regions of Australia. The conversation's changed dramatically in recent years. A few years ago, you'd go in and you'd get a very negative reaction. Now, people are much more focused on the opportunities of the transition. Yes, the need for some retraining and appropriate investments and support as people make this transition, but not as much as you might think, because energy is energy. And if you're a skilled energy worker, regardless of whether it's traditional fossil fuels or renewable energy, you have a skill set which we need much more of. There are, again, some transition issues. For example, one of the great opportunities, like we haven't even talked about it tonight, one of the great opportunities for our country is we have 9 out of the 10, we have very large deposits and 9 out of the 10 minerals we need for batteries, which need to be extracted and value-added, ideally, in Australia. But they're in different places to where coal is, for example, so there'll be sort of economic developments in different places as to where the economic transformation is occurring. But again, there are also great opportunities. I talked about offshore wind. I mentioned Gippsland and the Hunter, two of our 6 offshore wind zones. It is no coincidence that we've picked offshore wind zones to match areas that have traditionally produced coal. That's no coincidence. Did that on purpose. Offshore wind is energy rich. I mentioned that one energy farm in the Gippsland, Star of the South, it's called, would produce 20% of Victoria's energy needs. One turn of one turbine, one turn of one offshore wind turbine produces as much energy as your solar panels on your roof do all day, because it's very windy offshore, and they turn 15 times a minute, and there's roughly 200 turbines, say, on an average farm. Also, it tends to be windy at night offshore, whereas wind can fall onshore at night, so it helps balance the system. So it's very important, but it's jobs rich. Because it's so windy, the turbines need more maintenance. Because they're offshore, they need ships to take the workers out. It's highly jobs rich. And again, it makes sense to make those offshore wind zones attached to areas undergoing economic transformation like Gippsland and the Hunter, because it creates jobs. So it is part of that it is a very important part of the mix which needs management. The Prime Minister set up a cabinet task force, which he chairs and I'm the deputy chair of, on this very issue, on the transition, to consider further changes and architecture necessary going forward. It's front of centre, front of mind for us.
I'm Rafe Champion from the Energy Realists of Australia. Over the last 3 years, we've sent dozens of briefing notes to 800 politicians Australia-wide. The centrepiece of our concern is the phenomenon of wind droughts. Now, in your presentation, you mentioned that the sun's always shining or the wind's always blowing somewhere across the country. Well, it's a simple, very clearly documented by any amount of records that there are wind droughts with little or no wind across the whole of southeast Australia for up to 3 days. To be brief, have you not been told that? And secondly, what will you do when you find out about it?
Well, of course there are periods where it's not windy. Of course there are. Right? But that just makes the transition more important to manage. What we have to do is prepare for a period of Dunkelflaute, a concept you'd be very familiar with. Now, if you prepare for Dunkelflaute, the German word for what you were referring to, then you increase transmission and you increase storage. That's a pretty simple underlying principle. So you have, even if it's not the case that happens very often, and you talked about Southeast Queensland, of course, the Southeast Australia, the national energy grid covers from the southern tip of Tasmania to the northern tip of Queensland and into South Australia. It's a very wide area with a very wide range of resources available to it on any given day. But that's part of what we're doing, increasing the storage, increasing the transmission to deal with periods, because prudent planning would suggest we should.
The question here.
Minister, thank you for your presentation. I was wondering if you could comment on the land use competition issues that are emerging, for example, transmission lines, wind farms and so forth, and how you and the federal government proposes to speed that process up to meet your timelines.
So it's a very important question. I wouldn't say it so much as speeding it up, well, that's a legitimate issue, but speeding it up in a way that is able to be done faster because you've brought communities with you better is the way I would characterise it. I think it actually reaches its pointy end in transmission. Yes, wind farms sometimes, but basically, there is a system to manage that, and if a wind farm doesn't meet environmental standards, it shouldn't proceed. But actually, I find, in my experience, it's at its most acute with transmission. It's new in terms of the expansion. It's controversial. And frankly, our community consultation as a country has not been good enough. And communities often, in my experience, and I've met with them extensively, say, well, we're not anti-renewables, we're pro-renewables. We're not anti-transmission, we're pro-transmission. But the way this is done costs our community and the country benefits, but we don't. And I think that, in many instances, correct. So we're going to do much better at working those issues through. It's partly about money, to be frank. Victoria and New South Wales now pay $200,000 a kilometre over 20 years. That's a good thing, because landowners deserve that payment. But it's not just about money. It's about the impact on the community managers. So we have, I've announced reforms to what's called the RIT-T process, which is the regulatory process, quite complicated and convoluted and badly named. But it's not really designed for the sorts of exercise we're undertaking as a country is designed for small additions, not big re-engineering. So we're to do much better than that. And we are doing that with the states, reforming that system so that communities are actually consulted much earlier in a much more meaningful way. Because when they come in and say, look, you guys have really already decided this line's going here, this is not real consultation, too often they've been right. And often they're not trying to kill the project, they just think there's a better way. And they know the community better than any bureaucrat in Sydney, Melbourne or Canberra. So they should have a proper say, as well as the proper compensation and other things. So that's a pretty big and important part of our agenda. Also, I just make the point on wind, that that's another reason to develop an offshore wind zone. Yes, there's social licence issues there as well. We go through those. I mean, when I put out the draft Gippsland zone, it was 27,000 square kilometres. We took submissions, I read them all, and I reached the view that some of them were well made, and we reduced the area from 27,000 to 15,000 square kilometres because they raised legitimate issues. If the consultation process is real and people have a real say and they're listened to, might not always like the end outcome, but there's a proper process where their views are taken into account. I think we can much better manage many of those issues.
Thank you very much, Minister Fred Chilton. Thank you for your comments about gas and the importance of gas in transition. It just seems to me there is a visceral anti-gas attitude among many, and many are uninformed. So what is your government doing in terms of education to educate the general public that gas is important and new gas projects need to be done if we want to keep the lights on?
Well, I think I was doing some of that in my remarks, and I do that.
Yes, but this is an educated audience.
Well, yes, but I'm sure. But we have to do that everywhere we go. We do. I mean, you know, I do it in my media interviews. The Prime Minister did it the other day at the BCA function. You know, gas is an important underpinning of this important transition because it is flexible. That's its biggest virtue, in my view. It's so flexible. You can turn a traditional gas-fired power station on and off with 15 minutes notice, which you can't do with coal, obviously. But increasingly, you can do it with 5 minutes notice with some investments in the gas-fired power stations to make them more flexible. That's absolutely key, being able to turn them on and off quickly as we manage with renewable energy. And that's why we've rejected the request, suggestion, demand that we ban new gas as part of our safeguard reforms, because it would be irresponsible. And I've said that on, you know, in multiple interviews and done my best to explain why.
Time for one quick question.
Very quick. Minister, thanks very much for your presentation. James Thomas. The New South Wales government recently doubled down on diesel ferries with a tender for the Parramatta route for another 7 diesel ferries. How is the decarbonisation of the maritime sector going in Australia more broadly, and how important do you see it?
It's very important. I think, James, more of it in terms of, I mean, I'm not here to undermine or dismiss the importance of the Sydney Parramatta ferries, because every emission is important, but more important for us as a maritime nation is international shipping. And I think I'm right in saying it's something like this. If international shipping were a country, it would be the 7th largest emitter in the world, something like that. For, you know, pretty obvious reasons, these are big ships with big payloads going long distances, and it has to be changed. So we're working with international partners on research and development, with members of the International Green Shipping Alliance and some other bodies. Ultimately, it'll come down to some combination of biofuels and green hydrogen, I believe. For shipping both small and large, although electric ships are real and do have a lot of capacity, just like electric cars, and for short-haul electric planes. We'll probably be seeing electric planes fly, say, Sydney-Canberra in the not-too-distant future, not long-haul. That'll be biofuel, sustainable aviation fuel for longer-haul flights. But for shorter-haul and for I'm sure it's a shame for shipping. There are electric ships under development for those sorts of things, but look, we're not there yet.
Finally, I've got a Zoom question which takes us back to, I think, the first question and links up with the Prime Minister's visit in the United States. Minister, you've ruled out nuclear power as a source of energy in Australia, Australia has committed to having nuclear-powered submarines. Given the complexity of running nuclear submarines, how is Australia going to do this without a domestic nuclear industry?
Well, I mean, the previous government made it clear that the two weren't linked when they announced AUKUS. Prime Minister Morrison said we do not need a domestic nuclear industry for this task, and he was correct about that. We don't. We need a focused skill set on the management of nuclear submarines, which we're working closely with friends and partners, particularly in the United States, United Kingdom, to develop. We have obviously some time to do so. But the previous government saw no link between nuclear submarines and a domestic nuclear industry, and I see no link.
Many thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, as you know, Chris Bowen is a cabinet minister, and they're very, very busy, and he has an extremely busy portfolio. So on behalf of Jacqueline and Anne and the rest of us at the Sydney Institute, we're very grateful for you giving up your time tonight to come along, talk to our audience. It's been recorded, go up on YouTube, and for taking so many questions from all different kinds of view, of all different kinds of views. So we're very grateful for that. And so I'd just like to say thanks for a great performance. We'd love to have you back sometime, hopefully before the next election or just after. But for tonight, thank you and well done.